Lecture 21, The Mood of the Hellenistic Age.
Welcome back to our series of lectures on Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic Age. We have tried to break the Hellenistic Age down into a series of discrete compartments or units that would allow us to conduct our survey a little bit more thoroughly. And so we've looked at the politics of the age, beginning with Alexander's career, the establishment of the various Hellenistic kingdoms. And we've also looked at the culture of the age. We've examined its sculpture, its poetry, its philosophy. And we've looked at its art, and finally, more recently, we've been looking at the economy of the age. And I've tried to suggest that though the economy grew during the Hellenistic period, it was also a period of great social unrest, a period of great upheaval. There are some aspects of cultural activity, cultural production, that almost defy general categorization. And I've actually put some of these together into one lecture. Aspects of the Hellenistic Age which in some ways relate to each other, but which can only be generally lumped together by calling it the mood of the Hellenistic Age. What I would like to do in this lecture is to examine the way in which the atmosphere of the Hellenistic period, the general appearance of the age, the zeitgeist, if you will, is somewhat different from what we find in the earlier periods of Greek history, whether it be the archaic or more recently the classical. And if we approach it from this point of view, trying to broadly encompass the entire age and to make generalizations about it, I think that there are at least three major features of the age that are distinctive and deserve closer attention. One is what we might call internationalism. It is an age in which, because Greek culture is extrapolated over such a larger area, there are now institutions which are repeated new areas, institutions that make people Greek, whether they be in Greece or whether they be in Afghanistan or in Upper Egypt. So we're going to talk about what constitutes internationalism in a moment. It's also an age in which a fascination with the individual is very important, and I want to look at some of the areas in which that is expressed in, say, the writing of history and in some of the philosophical works. And then finally, we'll look at the fascination with fate. And though these three areas all look disparate, they are all, I think, very characteristic qualities that mark the Hellenistic Age as something distinct and separate from earlier periods. The Greeks of the Hellenistic world were well aware of the fact that theirs was a Greek world, a Greek culture, much larger than the actual territory of Greece. And they had a word for this. They referred to it as the oikoumene, the commonwealth, as we would call it, sometimes also referred to just more simply as the koine, the common world, the world that was culturally Greek. Koine coming from the Greek adjective meaning common. This term refers then to a cultural zone which existed wherever there were Greek communities. And it corresponds very closely to what in more modern times we would call the Levant, that is to say, the Eastern Mediterranean. Koine referred not only to the oikoumene, the commonwealth, the Greek world, the common area, it also referred to the language spoken in that cultural zone. That language was, of course, Greek, but the Greek that had been spoken back in the Greek mainland in earlier periods had been marked by many different dialects. We know this from the early inscriptions from Greece. Greek is a phonetic language, and so if there are changes in pronunciation in northern or southern or eastern or western Greece, these will be marked by different spellings on our inscriptions. So that it was a language that had originally had very distinctive dialectical differences, but now what happens in the Hellenistic Age is that a more standardized, a more common form, koine, of Greek begins to emerge. It really is a phenomenon somewhat similar to the spread of the English language in modern times, where it is now possible to find a kind of standard English spoken at least in the southeast of England that's very different from all the various dialects of English spoken there, and which is sometimes assimilated to Californian English or other varieties of English, producing a fairly neutral accent. Koine Greek worked the same way. It was a standardized form of Greek. It's the language in which the New Testament is composed, even though there are some Aramaic elements in the language of the New Testament as well. But it's a good example of the spread of this common Greek, so that even the people of Judea are acquiring this, and it's being used for writing down the Gospels. The Jewish scriptures also, we've seen already, were translated from Hebrew into Greek, and the Greek that they're translated into is once again Koine Greek, the common Greek of the Hellenistic age. Supposedly this was done on the order of Ptolemy II, and tradition maintains that it was performed by 70 scholars who came to Alexandria for the task, and it's from that term for 70 that the Greek translation of the Old Testament takes its name, the Septuagint. It means the 70. Koine, of course, did not emerge overnight, and differences in pronunciation could still be heard in the Hellenistic period. In fact, a poet with a good ear for language like Theocritus seems to have been particularly interested in dialectical differences, so that in one of his idylls, and it's in fact the one I read to you involving the two women Gorgo and Praxinoa, who are rushing off to the palace to hear a recital, one of the pleasures of reading that in the original is that the actual language spoken by those two women is Doric Greek, the broad Greek associated both with Sparta and also with Syracuse, the city from which they originally come before they had moved to Alexandria. So the differences didn't die out altogether, and the poet here seemed to be interested in getting that down on paper and showing how these people spoke. I imagine that it would be a little like Alexander Pope writing a poem and trying to capture the brogue of either a couple of Irish ladies or perhaps some women who've come down from Glasgow. To the Hellenistic world, internationalism was not simply a matter of a standard form of Greek. And as I've argued on a number of occasions during this course of lectures, it also did not really mean fusing with other Greek cultures. Rather, internationalism in the Hellenistic period really means a kind of exportation of Greek culture and a uniform Greek culture which can be replicated, whether you are in Macedon, whether you are in southern Greece, whether you're on the Nile, whether you're on the Orontes, whether you're in Mesopotamia or out in Bactria. And this was accomplished thanks to a number of institutions which are characteristic of the Hellenistic period. For example, many Greek states now employed doctors, architects, teachers, and gymnastic trainers. And these professionals tended to repeat the practice of Greek culture wherever they went. The introduction of public education is one of the interesting developments of the period. We have good evidence for it from a number of Greek sites. The city of Teos, for example, in Asia Minor, leaves us an inscription from the 2nd century that includes the following stipulations. Every year at the elections, after the selection of the scribes, three schoolmasters are to be appointed. The first person, they are to teach the boys and the girls. The first person to teach the first class will get 600 drachmas a year, the second class 550, and the third class will get 500 drachmas. There are also to be two physical trainers, so the boys and the girls are meant to get their exercise at school as well as their learning. There is to be a lute player, so music is an important part of their education. They're to be taught music. There is also to be a drill sergeant. So good military training is meant to be part of their education as well, and they will be taught archery and javelin throwing. And so it goes on with various regulations about how the school is meant to be organized. So we have an idea here that what's emerging is a kind of standardized curriculum. A Greek boy in Macedon and a Greek boy in Sparta, a Greek boy in Alexandria and a Greek boy in Mesopotamia is likely to be going to school, reading the same poets, being exercised in exactly the same way, learning the same kind of musical scales. Doctors also helped to export Greek culture because they ended up being employed far and wide around the Mediterranean. We have, for example, an inscription that comes from the island of Samos, which talks about the good work done by their public doctor. It says, Since Diodorus, son of Dioscorides, who took over among us the task of public doctor, has for many years in the previous period, through his own skill and care, looked after and cured many of the citizens and the others of the city who had fallen seriously ill, and since he took care of people when the earthquakes took place, many of us had suffered painful wounds of every sort because of the unexpected disaster, but he assisted all of them, and it goes on to, in typical Hellenistic fashion, to vote him a series of honours. What the inscription reveals to us is that we've got doctors often coming from the island of Kos, operating all around the Greek world. Another institution which contributed to this sense of similarity, of homogeneity, if you like, in Greek culture and Greek practices was that of Greek drama. Not only do we have now the great plays of Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides being performed all over the Eastern Mediterranean, but we have bands of travelling performers known as the technetai, the technicians, if you like, of Dionysus. Yes, they're actors, but they're also a religious brotherhood. A religious brotherhood that travels from city to city and on the occasion of the festivals of Dionysus will put on a performance of plays in honour of the god, since Greek drama was always enacted in honour of the god. They're an interesting phenomenon, and one of the inscriptions we have, I won't read it, it's far too long, is one of the longest inscriptions to come to us from the Hellenistic period. It is hundreds of lines long. And what it shows us is that these technicians of Dionysus, this guild of actors, which is really the best way of expressing it in English, felt vulnerable because they travelled a lot. And as we've already seen, there was always the risk of being captured by pirates. So what did they do? They got a royal patron. A royal patron who gave them money to help them and also wrote them a document which they could show in case they came under attack from pirates, saying that they were being offered asulia, that is to say asylum, and asphalia, that is to say safe passage guaranteed by the king of Egypt. So it's a good example of how many of the features that we've seen are coming together. The unsettled nature of the times, the importance of the power of the king in being able to guarantee, in this instance at least, the safety of these itinerant actors. Professional teachers brought Greek education wherever the Greeks settled, and it wasn't merely a matter of Greek teachers or professors being employed, but an entire institution that was associated with Greek education. That institution was, of course, the gymnasium. This is where young men go for their education. And the presence of a gymnasium in a city, which is fairly easy usually to find archaeologically, the presence of a gymnasium and the presence of a theatre tells you that you've got a Greek city, a city that regards itself as being Greek. And you'll recall that when we looked at the revolt of the Maccabees, when the Hellenizing Jews in Alexandria came to power, what they attempted to do was to put up a gymnasium in the city. In other words, to advertise that this was no longer merely a Jewish city, but it was now also a Hellenistic city, a city with Greek culture. And one finds these both in Judea and in Alexandria and all the way across to Iconium, where a gymnasium also has been found. As a result, the man in charge of the gymnasium became one of the most important public officials in the Hellenistic state. He's usually known as the gymnasiarch. And again, we have inscriptions from many parts of the Greek world, hundreds of lines long. We don't have them back into the classical or archaic period, but in the Hellenistic period, many of these dealing with the establishment of a gymnasium. One that we have comes to us from Macedonia, and it has extraordinarily detailed stipulations about how the gymnasiarch is to be selected, how he is to run the gymnasium, who the supporting officials are who are to work with him, how he's to take care of things. Concerning the boys, none of the youngsters may enter among the boys nor talk to the boys, otherwise the gymnasiarch shall fine and prevent anyone who does any of these things. And it goes on to talk about the physical trainers. It goes to talk about how the gymnasiarch has to make sure that certain people are not allowed into the gymnasium. So he's acting in loco parentis. No one may enter the gymnasium or take off his clothes if he is a slave, if he is a freedman, if he is the son of either of these, if he has not been to the wrestling school, if he is a pederast, if he has practiced a vulgar trade, if he is a drunk, or if he is mad. So this is an institution that's being set up for the first time to train all the boys of the city on a regular basis, and people are making sure that they've got someone of good, sound, moral character running the whole show. Now, for the Greeks and for those who adopted Greek culture, those who were Hellenized, there were other institutions which helped in this process, not institutions that were replicated in the cities, but rather institutions to which people came. And most important here is that of the Greek sanctuaries. Sanctuaries had always played an important role in Greek culture. Remember that in the earlier period of Greek history, there was no united Greece. The Greeks were never politically united, but they were culturally united. And one way in which this was expressed by the meetings that took place on a regular basis at places such as Nemea, Isthmia, Delphi, and of course Olympia. These places are in fact known as Pan-Hellenic shrines. In other words, the places where all the Greeks meet together. Now, in the Hellenistic age, other shrines attempted to attain a status that was equal to this. And in fact, there is now, for the first time in Hellenistic Greek, an expression, iso olympiakos, which means equal in status to the Olympics. So that if you became, if your sanctuary attained that status, then you now became essentially a pan-Hellenic shrine as well. One of the places that emerged as a large and wealthy sanctuary that really flourished in the Hellenistic period as never before was Delos. Hellenistic Delos gives us a good idea of the connection between trade, economy, and culture going on in the Hellenistic period. Between 300 BC and 166 BC, the early Hellenistic period in other words, the island was independent and it enjoyed a great deal of prosperity thanks to its central location and the prestige of the sanctuary of Apollo. In 166 BC, smack bang in the middle of the Hellenistic Age, Rome took control of the island and it gave it into the safekeeping of Athens. Now, the small island of Delos lost its independence, but it was compensated for, this was compensated for by being given a tax-free status. And this made Delos the busiest port in the Aegean for the next century. Now, this we might regard as merely a matter of economics. It is something like the Singapore, if you will, of the ancient Aegean, sucking trade into it as people come here. And we know of many slave ships, for example, that came in. There are estimates of 10,000 slaves per day being sold on the island of Delos. But it isn't merely a matter of crude economics of that sort. We know that as the island gained in economic status, and because it already was a sanctuary dedicated to Apollo, it also increased in religious status at the same time. And one of the most remarkable documents in this respect takes us back to a cult we've already looked at, the cult of Serapis. And you'll remember that I mentioned in an earlier lecture that the cult of Serapis, this fusion of Greek and Egyptian elements, was actually a successful export from Egypt and became popular around the Hellenistic world. Well, we in fact have a document that gives us the ground zero for when that cult left Egypt and landed on the island of Delos. It comes in a letter recorded by a man called Apollonius. And this Apollonius, it's a good Greek name, comes from a long family of men who were priests. Interestingly enough, in this letter, he talks about his grandfather, whose name was also Apollonius, but he says his grandfather was an Egyptian. So somewhere along the line, earlier in the family's history, they've dropped their Egyptian names and adopted Greek names. And we do have other letters, inscriptions, and petitions that show this, with people sometimes having a Greek name and saying, also known as X, followed by an Egyptian name, Greek and Egyptian. This man says that his grandfather lived to the age of 97 and then his father succeeded his grandfather and worshipped the gods in the same way, and he lived for 61 years. Now, they're priests of Serapis, this family, and it's a priesthood passed on. When, says Apollonius, when I inherited the sacred objects and devoted myself carefully to the cult, the god told me in my sleep that a Serapium, a shrine of Serapis, of his own must be dedicated to him and that he must not be as before in a rented building. He said he would find a spot himself where he should be set and that he would point it out. So, you know, they've rented a little shrine on Delos, but this isn't enough for the gods. So he's finally said to Apollonius, this won't cut it. I need to have my own shrine. So he appears to Apollonius. and he points out to him exactly where the spot is to be. Now, this spot was full of dirt and was advertised for sale on a little notice in the passage to the Agora. As the god wanted this, the purchase was completed and the sanctuary was rapidly built in 6 months. And when some men joined against us and the god had introduced a public suit against the sanctuary, they're sued for trying to put up their local church, against the sanctuary and me, involving a penalty or a fine, the god promised to me in my sleep that we would be victorious. Now that the trial is completed and we have won a victory worthy of the god, we praise the gods and repay them adequate thanks. So here the story has a happy ending, and the shrine was successfully built continued to flourish for some time afterwards. So shrines represent, as they pop up like mushrooms, the exporting of these fused Hellenistic religions, and they're exported all around the Mediterranean. There are a number of gods of the period, not only gods like Serapis, who are new to the Greeks, but there are a number of other gods who gain even greater significance in the period, and their popularity attests once again to, I think, this international culture. The one who is probably most important at this time is Asclepius. Now, Asclepius had been known to the Greeks prior to the Hellenistic period, and certainly in the 4th century he was treated as a god, although it appears that in earlier periods he may have been regarded as a hero and as a very powerful man rather than a god. But by this time, in the Hellenistic age, he is certainly being treated as a healer god, a god who can step in to help people. And the best known instance that we have of his worship comes from Epidaurus, the site, of course, of one of the great theatres in modern Greece, still to be seen. What people often don't know is that at Epidaurus there was an Asclepieum, a shrine in honour of the god Asclepius. And it wasn't merely a temple, it included a dormitory where people would come and where they would sleep overnight. They would experience the kinds of dreams that we've already seen in some of our documents. And in these dreams, the god would either appear and heal them, or else he would give them indications of the course of therapy they were meant to undergo later on. People came from all around Greece to be healed by the god. And there were a number of shrines in his honour. This is only the most famous. One of the reasons it's famous is because after people were healed, they left testimonials saying, "This is what the god did to me." These testimonials were then engraved, they were inscribed on stone, so that as you walked into the sanctuary, you got to read the stories of all the people who'd been cured. Here's a couple of them. Cleo was pregnant for 5 years. After already 5 years of pregnancy, she came as a suppliant to the god and went to sleep in the innermost sanctuary. As soon as she came out of it and was outside the sanctuary, she gave birth to a boy, who, as soon as he was born, washed himself from the fountain and walked about with his mother. I mean, he was 5 years old, of course he was able to walk. After being granted this favour, she wrote the following inscription on her dedication. "It is not the greatness of the tablet that deserves admiration, but the divinity. As Cleo was pregnant with child in her womb for 5 years until she went to sleep, and the divinity restored her to health." So this both attests to the strong sense of the real involvement of the gods in your day-to-day life, something we've talked about already. But the fact that this is replicated through so much of the Greek world also talks to our idea of internationalism. And these stories would circulate around the Greek world. On the island of Kos, there was another Asclepieum, another sanctuary of Asclepius, and what is most fascinating about that particular sanctuary is that it was located on the same island and not very far away from a medical school which had been founded by the followers of Hippocrates, of course, of the Hippocratic Oath. Now, what I think this strongly suggests is that on the island of Kos, when you arrived, you could make your choice either of going to the sanctuary and trying to get a religious cure, a divine cure, or else going to the doctors and going for a scientific, secular cure. And I am absolutely convinced that there were many people who tried one, and if it didn't work, they went over and tried the other. It makes absolutely good sense. Sanctuaries benefited from the generosity of the Hellenistic kings, and they repaid their largesse, that is to say, the sanctuaries repaid the largesse of their patrons by conferring great prestige on these kings. So the sanctuaries act as a way of replicating this Hellenistic power relationship that we've seen so often. The cult of the Kabiri, for example, is a rather obscure mystery cult. We don't know the details of what was involved here, of what the myth or the story was. We do know that it was located on the island of Samothrace, and it was the largest international sanctuary, if you will, located near Macedon. And so it had become quite popular with the Macedonian dynasts. There's even a story that Philip and Olympias, the parents of Alexander the Great, met here. It also became quite popular later on with the Ptolemies, and it was eventually endowed with all sorts of magnificent buildings, with fountains, with monumental structures, and with temples, all in honor of various members of the Ptolemaic and other dynasties. Now, we've talked a lot about the international character of the age, but I also wanted to talk about the individualism of the age. And we find here, we've seen this already in the sculpture of the age, and we've seen it to some extent in the philosophy as well, with an interest in the individual. But there are other works that are particularly interesting here. Theophrastus, for example, who was a student of Aristotle, came to write a comic treatise that dealt with different types of characters: the suspicious man, the oligarchic man, the conservative man, and so forth. So he was exploring here different types of character. Menander's comic plays also are interested in individuals. They're not interested just now in the affairs of the city-state, as had been the plays of Aristophanes, which were largely the plays about democratic life in Athens. Menander's plays instead are somewhat more like modern-day sitcoms. They're about recognizable families. They're about the dilemmas that families face. What happens if a parent dies and a child is left without a guardian, for example? And imitating many of the themes of the Hellenistic novels, what happens if a boy and a girl meet, fall in love, but then get separated? So there's an individualism there in the plays of the time and in Theophrastus's work as well. But then that other theme that we can't ignore that runs throughout the whole of the Hellenistic period is this notion of the unpredictability of fortune. In the Greek novels, as we've seen, heroes and heroines are constantly suffering a reversal of fortune. They're constantly being reunited only to be separated again by a storm or a pirate attack. But this idea of fortune wasn't something merely used by novelists or poets. It was an idea very seriously explored also by historians. They were pursuing the idea that fortune, capricious fortune, might play a role in destiny and history. Two historians, Durus and Phylarchus, were both notorious for writing histories that highlighted the role of fortune, a dramatic change in circumstances leading to the collapse of fortunes of one of the great leaders. And these highly emotional histories that they produced were often then referred to as tragic history, because they really blurred the line between a kind of dramatic story that you would expect on the stage and a sober history. Polybius, who was probably the best Greek historian after Thucydides, deplored this emphasis on sensationalism and the dramatic impact of fortune, decrying this tragic history. And yet, even Polybius, ironically enough, often refers to the role of Tyche, or as the Romans would later call her, Fortuna, in history. So, yes, the Greek term for this, as I've just said, is Tyche. And from the 4th century onwards, it's not merely a concept, it's not merely an abstract noun, as the word fortune is in English. She's a goddess. She's a personified goddess. She actually receives cult honors, so people can go and worship at a shrine and make a dedication to Tyche in Athens from the 4th century and further abroad as well. In the East, she becomes, as is so often the case, incorporated with other goddesses. There is a Semitic goddess, Gad, who is often regarded as being similar to Tyche, and once again, all of these will be assimilated into Isis on various occasions. She could be capricious, she could be malevolent, but by the same token she could also be the protector of cities. And so one increasingly finds during the Hellenistic period then statues and engraved gems, in some cases terracotta plaques or glass bowls, on which one will see a woman representing the city. She may be crowned, representing, with the crown showing the walls of the city, representing the city, and she becomes the kind of genius or the guardian spirit, synonymous with the spirit of the city itself. So this is a very complex age when it comes to new developments that make it different from the period that came before. The Greeks, yes, they'd always believed in a healing god, and yes, they'd always believed in fortune, and yes, they'd always been fascinated by the individual and by what makes up Greek culture, all of these elements, yes. But one finds many of these elements being given fresh impetus and fresh interest in the work of the Hellenistic age, an age that produced a culture which, for the first time, probably in the Eastern Mediterranean, can be genuinely called international.